5 years ago, for the third time in my life, I ceased to exist. I was having a small operation, and my brain was filling with anesthetic. Anesthesia is the art of turning people into objects. General anesthesia doesn't just work on your brain or on your mind, it works on your consciousness. By altering the delicate electrochemical balance within the neural circuitry inside your head, the basic ground state of what it is to be is temporarily abolished. In this process lies one of the greatest remaining mysteries in science and in philosophy too. Welcome to Leafing Through Science, where we dive into the pages of popular books in the life sciences with the writers who made them happen, from new releases to timeless classics. What if your experience of the world, everything you see, hear, and feel, isn't a direct window onto reality, but a carefully controlled hallucination generated by your brain? And what if your sense of self, the feeling of being you, is just another one of those hallucinations? I am your host, Teddy Young, and this week I'm delighted to welcome one of the leading voices in the science of consciousness, Professor Anil Seth. Anil's PhD took him through an unexpected but fruitful detour into artificial intelligence and robotics before a six-year stint as a postdoc at the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego gave him the opportunity he'd long been waiting for to study consciousness head-on. There, he worked with the Nobel laureate Gerald Edelman, and for over a decade now, he's been running a lab at the University of Sussex in the south of England, where he is also director of the Sussex Centre for Consciousness Science. Anil, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Eddie. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We'll be discussing Anil's wonderful book, Being You, A New Science of Consciousness, which to me exemplifies what great science communication is all about, challenging how you see the world and your place within it, and turning much of what you thought you knew on its head. Just as it may seem that the sun is going around the earth and not the other way around, so it seems that our conscious experience is a reflection of reality rather than a construction of it. But as we'll see, things are not always what they seem, and often the truth may be just the opposite. Not long ago, life was considered just as mysterious as consciousness is today. Many believed it couldn't be explained by physical or chemical processes alone, a view called vitalism. Prominent scientists like Pasteur supported the idea that life required a special force or spark, but over time, science showed that no such force was needed, and vitalism has since been fully rejected. And now, researchers around the world are chipping away at the edges of consciousness, working to demystify this last remaining bastion of human exceptionalism, and to explain its properties in terms of mechanisms in the brain and body, one step at a time. So, Anil, before we dive in, I think it would be useful for our listeners if you just briefly define what we actually mean by consciousness.
Yeah, I can try. But I mean, as you nicely illustrated with the example of life, definitions change along with our evolving understanding. And I expect the case with consciousness will be the same, that the definitions we have and the questions we ask will also not remain the same. And that can be a marker of progress. That said, some kind of definition is important. Otherwise, we end up talking about different things and everything becomes a big mess. So the definition that I tend to use comes from the philosopher Thomas Nagel. 50 years ago now, or more than 50, 51 years ago, he had a very influential paper, kind of a mini book really, called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And in that paper, he offered a definition which has become pretty standard. And he says, For a conscious organism, there is something it is like to be that organism. And the intuition, I think, here is that it feels like something to be me. It feels like something to be you. For any conscious system, whether it's a human being, a non-human animal, perhaps some cells in a dish, perhaps a language model in AI, though I don't think so. If these things are conscious, then it will feel like something to be that thing. I like this because it's very liberal in a sense. It doesn't define consciousness in terms of things which may be true for human beings, but not true in general. So it's not confusing consciousness with the self or with intelligence or with language. It's simply the fact that there is some kind of experiencing going on, whether it's the redness of red or the paininess of pain. Anything like that counts. That's consciousness. It's what goes away when you're under general anesthesia, is another good way to put it.
And when talking about consciousness, phrases you'll hear again and again are the easy problem and the hard problem. The easy problem, though it's not actually easy at all, refers to explaining how the brain carries out specific tasks, like how we recognize a face or make a decision. And these are difficult, but in principle, they're problems we can solve by studying the brain's machinery. The deeper mystery, the hard problem, is why any of this processing is accompanied by conscious experience at all. Why should electrical signals and brain activity give rise to the blue of a summer sky or the feeling of being me? And the hard problem is exemplified by the so-called zombie thought experiment. And this is where you have a philosophical zombie, a hypothetical being that looks and behaves exactly like a conscious person, but has no inner experience. It walks, talks, and does everything you or I do, yet none of its behavior is accompanied by conscious awareness. And it raises the question, why does consciousness need to be involved in producing behavior at all? And I think you offer a compelling explanation for why imagining such a being doing everything we do while being hollow inside isn't actually as plausible as it might first seem.
Yeah, so this you're right, the zombie thought experiment has been doing the rounds for a long time, and it's interesting, and there are different ways you can interpret it. But broadly, you're right. It asks us to imagine some creature that's behaviorally indistinguishable. So on the outside, you can't tell the difference between real conscious me and zombie me, to the extent that I will be saying the same things now about consciousness if I were zombie me, but without anything going on inside for it to be me doing that. And you know, if that's possible, the argument goes, then it's sort of demonstrates, or it certainly undermines, the idea that consciousness could have a physical explanation, because it seems to be somewhat optional in accounting for the behavior of a system. But as with many thought experiments of this kind, they're called conceivability experiments. They ask us to conceive something and then draw implications from whether this thing is conceivable. But they only work if it really is conceivable. And now, you know, this gets into philosophical weeds about, well, what counts as being conceivable? Is it conceivable in the universe with the laws of physics as we have them? Or is it like conceivable given some other laws of physics in some other universe? And I mean, I tend to think, to be interesting, it has to be conceivability, like in the universe in which we live. And then it becomes very doubtful whether these zombies are indeed conceivable. It's one of these cases where the more you know about something, the less conceivable these strange possibilities are. I give the example in the book of aircraft like a Boeing 787 flying backwards. Well, in a sense, it's easy to imagine. I just imagine a plane in the air going backwards, right? Easy. But of course, it's not easy. Planes can't fly backwards. And the more you know about the laws of physics and aerodynamics, the more implausible it becomes to imagine such a thing. And I think the same goes for the brain. The more we understand the intimate connections between brains, conscious experiences, and behavior, the less plausible it becomes to imagine all this going on in the absence of any conscious experience. So yeah, I'm kind of unmoved by the zombie thought experiment, but many people are, and it does put pressure on. Okay, so what are these internet connections? If the implausibility of backwards flying planes is supported by a deeper understanding of some of aerodynamics and engineering and physics, what's the equivalent in the understanding of consciousness?
Right. And in your book, you actually outline a third approach, which you call the real problem of consciousness, which goes after the hard problem indirectly, and which you argue offers the most promising path forward for a successful science of consciousness. And could you briefly outline what you mean by the real problem?
Yeah, I've done this kind of cheeky thing here, basically slapping a label on what a lot of people do anyway. So I have no claim that this is new or novel, but I do think it helps to demarcate it, both as a practical strategy, even though many people have been following versions of it long before I was ever around, and also to sort of contrast with this hard problem and easy problem that you beautifully explained. So the real problem in that sense, in relation to the other problems, is a sort of a slight swerve. Instead of trying to solve this seemingly intractable mystery head on, the analogy with life again comes back. Instead of trying to find the élan vital that explains the difference between the living and the non-living, let's instead just recognize that consciousness exists, and that it has various properties. It has global properties that can be altered in things like anesthesia and sleep. And it has local properties, what we are conscious of when we are conscious, the sights and sounds and smells and so on. And within that, there's the experience of self. And if we can begin to explain, account for these properties in terms of mechanisms in the brain and body, why is one experience the way it is and not like another experience? Why does visual experience have the character, the experiential character that it does? Then I think we make progress, and the hard problem becomes less and less salient. As we begin to in this way chip away at the hard problem, the idea that there needs to be something sort of substantive there to be explained diminishes. In the same way that as we understood more about properties of life, the motivation for looking for an élan vital, something that the vitalists wanted, that motivation just kind of dissolved. So really the strategy is to not solve the hard problem, but dissolve it. And in practice, this means focusing our theories and our experiments, not always on what people can do, on cognitive function and behavior, but on what they experience, on the properties of experience itself. And that's just a sort of slight shift of emphasis that can mesh very comfortably with how a lot of people do experiments in psychology and neuroscience anyway. But we just make sure we focus on the experiential properties themselves.
Yeah, so let's try to make this a bit more concrete for our listeners. So here I'm holding a yellow mug. Now, if I see a yellow mug, the real problem of consciousness is about understanding why I have the specific subjective experience of a yellow mug rather than, say, a blue mug or a yellow teapot. And what is it about the wetware inside our heads and the particular patterns of brain activity that give rise to this experience and not another? How can we explain, predict, and even control the way this conscious experience arises from the brain?
Yeah, it's a good example. I mean, I've got my own mug here, which is a sort of multicolored mug, but yeah, I mean, there's a particular experience of seeing the mug, holding it, and drinking tea from it, whatever. And that's the challenge. What are the experiential properties of that experience, and how might they be accounted for?
But first, I'd like to talk about this idea of measuring consciousness. Mm. So in 1870, English biologist Thomas Henry Huxley, known as Charles Darwin's bulldog, said, "I believe that we shall sooner or later arrive at a mechanical equivalent of consciousness, just as we have arrived at a mechanical equivalent of heat." And in your book, you draw an analogy with temperature and recount the story of how coming up with a reliable way to measure temperature actually helped us to understand what temperature is. And you pose an intriguing question. If we could build a reliable consciousness meter that can precisely measure levels of consciousness, might that bring us closer to understanding the nature of consciousness itself? But before we get into the progress that's been made on this front, I just want to highlight an important point you make, which is that being conscious and being awake aren't always one and the same. For instance, when you're dreaming, you're clearly asleep, but you're still able to have vivid, often complex conscious experiences. And you also point out that consciousness seems to depend not on the whole brain, but on how specific parts of the brain speak to each other.
Yeah, so this analogy with temperature is kind of interesting. You know, we've talked about two historical parallels now. One is life and one is heat and thermometry, temperature. And they're both illuminating, but in different ways. So life is illuminating because it sort of suggests that things that were mysterious need not always be mysterious. And the heat example is interesting because it really showcases the value of being able to measure something. But the case of heat, there's a wonderful book, by the way, called Inventing Temperature by Hasok Chang, which I highly recommend to everybody listening as a wonderful account in this period in the history of philosophy of science that made a big impact on me when I was writing Being You. But of course, heat turned out to be one thing, right? The mean molecular kinetic energy of atoms and molecules of the stuff. And that's what heat is. And once you know that, it's kind of the end of the story, right? Then you can have thermodynamics, you can have everything. But there's this very, very straightforward reduction from heat to another physical quantity. It's not clear that consciousness will turn out that way, you know, that it will be unidimensional in that sense. Life did not turn out that way. As much as we understand about life now, it doesn't seem that we'll get to the stage where we have like a measure of how alive something is on a scale from like minus 270 to plus whatever, right? It's not going to turn out that way. Doesn't mean we understand it less. It just means it's not that kind of thing. So I do think there's a lot of value in trying to measure how conscious somebody or something is. But I suspect that it's not going to follow the same trajectory that we followed in the history of thermometry and heat.
And could you talk to us a bit about the zap and zip approach pioneered by the Italian neuroscientist Marcello Massimini, which tries to measure the level of consciousness with just a single number, a bit like a thermometer?
Yeah, so Marcello Massimini's studies have been amazingly well conducted and well received and rightly influential. And they basically look at how far can we get by this approach. We can apply a single number to level of consciousness, and that's useful as far as it goes. I mean, people in anesthesiology have done this for a long time, you know, to try to measure the depth of anesthesia, which is the equivalent of level of consciousness just in reverse. So Massimini's experiments go a little bit like this. You use a technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation. This injects a very short, sharp pulse of energy into the brain. And then you record what happens next, basically. You record the electrical echo of this pulse. And the more complex this echo is, the more it bounces around the brain over a long period of time, the higher the number. It's called the perturbation complexity index. And the more simple the echo is, the lower the number. And there are various ways where you can quantify this. They propose one way. And that gives you a very approximate single number measure of level of consciousness. Now, it's not really the same as the temperature thing, again, because consciousness is probably not in principle, going to lie along one dimension. And also, we don't really have the ability to generalize. Like, the thing about heat, once scales were established, it allowed us to talk about temperatures at the center of the sun, the surface of the sun, the depths of interstellar space, all of these things. So the measures that we have from the PCI and other similar measures applied to brain activity, they only really make sense in that context. You know, if we had a value from another system, let's say a lizard, I mean, you couldn't really infer that much from it. We don't have the kind of benchmarks or generalizable scale. But, you know, it's a good first step. To be honest, you didn't have that to begin with temperature either. You know, you had things that were very dependent on context, on the vessels you were using, whether it was a glass or something else, the altitude you were at. We know now all of these things are predictably confounding factors. But at the time, it was just like, well, you know, it couldn't generalize very well. But even with the methods that are available now, they're still very useful. And they can be refined, and we can try and make them more and more precise and see if they can be generalized, at least within human beings to some extent. And that's already beginning to happen. So I think it's a very promising approach.
And presumably these measures are capturing activity patterns in the brain that seem to matter most to consciousness, namely the thalamic cortical system, the combination of the cerebral cortex and the thalamus. And using this technique, which unlike standard clinical methods, doesn't depend on outward signs of behavior, they've been able to assess the conscious state of patients with severe brain injuries. They found the same measures of consciousness in patients with locked-in syndrome who are fully conscious but completely paralyzed as in healthy age-matched controls. And in your own research group, you've been developing similar methods to assessing levels of consciousness, only, as you put it, zipping without the zapping.
Yeah, it's kind of complementary, really, to Marcello Massimini's approach. And it's a number of groups are doing this. The application of the transcranial magnetic stimulation, it's great, but it's not applicable in many situations. It's not an easy thing to do. So it'd be nice to have some measure where you didn't need to do that and you could just record brain dynamics as they happen to be and analyze those and see how far we can get. So that's the kind of thing we do. We look at how compressible brain dynamics are. So this is the intuition that, you know, if you think about images, if you just have a simple checkerboard image, it's very easily compressible. Like you can represent that in a very small amount of information. Yeah, black square, white square, repeat. That's it. If you have a fully random visual snow white noise thing, in a sense, it's very easy because it's just do random stuff. But if you want to capture the precise pattern, it's very hard. You can't really compress it at all. So there are various measures which track compressibility in this sense. And if you apply those to the brain, to neurophysiological data, you get measures which also do quite well in tracking global conscious level. Now, they're a bit less reliable, I think, because, you know, when you apply a stimulus like transcranial magnetic stimulation, you know, you're kind of forcing the brain in a particular way, and that can, you're sort of less susceptible to whatever the pre-measurement context might have been. But it's still clear that you can do a lot with this simpler method. But I think, I mean, in my group right now, I've got a number of students and colleagues looking at this way of doing it, because these measures tend to sometimes behave a bit strangely. They may be influenced by other things unrelated to consciousness. So the state of things now, at least as far as I understand them, is there's a lot of candidate measures of this kind. You know, we've looked at a few, but there's loads out there, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done to figure out how they relate to each other, which ones are picking up on brain dynamics that are very specific to consciousness, and also how these things manage this trade-off between sensitivity and specificity. You know, we might have some measures which are very sensitive, but not very specific, that they may pick up things that are unrelated to consciousness. We might have measures, on the other hand, that are the opposite, that are very tightly focused on consciousness, but might miss it in some cases when it's actually there.
Yeah. So I was surprised to see that your measure of conscious level during REM sleep, when we're dreaming, was about the same as during normal wakefulness. And I was wondering, could it be that the inner movie we all experience when we're awake, the images we see but not with our eyes, the sounds we hear but not with our ears, is simply dialed up during dreams? And even though the external movie, what's actually coming in through our senses, is switched off, we still arrive at a similar measure of consciousness?
Well, I mean, I think the parallel is very deep. I must admit, I kind of resist the metaphor of the movie because it tends to encourage the idea that there's somebody in my head watching this movie when, mm-hmm. you know, that's just not the case, right? You know, you are part of the movie if there is a movie. But yeah, it's to me, it's not that surprising. And it really underlines the fact that waking experience is perhaps more dreamlike than we give it credit for. Not in the sense that it's weird and unrealistic and crazy stuff happens, but that what we experience when we're awake is primarily fundamentally an internal construction of the brain. It's not a passive window out onto objective reality.
Which brings us onto our next topic, because it's easy to forget just how hard a job our brains actually have. I mean, the brain is trapped inside a dark box, our skull, and has no direct access to the outside world. The only information it gets is indirect and comes in the form of electrical signals, information it gets through the senses. And from these signals alone, the brain has to figure out what's out there, what we see, hear, and feel. And if we take this yellow mug I'm holding, the common sense, or how things seem, view of perception is that it works from the bottom up. Light waves bounce off the mug, enter the eyes, and get converted into electrical signals, which are then processed by the brain. And first, the brain detects basic features like brightness and edges. Later, it pieces together more complex shapes until it recognizes the object as a mug. But in your book, you describe a very different picture of perception. You argue that what we see, hear, and feel are not the sensory inputs themselves, but rather the brain's best guesses about the causes of these sensory inputs. And these guesses are constantly being updated as new data comes in. And if we follow this idea to its full conclusion, we realize that our experience of the world is more like a controlled hallucination, as you put it, a kind of waking dream shaped by both sensory input and the brain's prior expectations. So what's actually happening, Anil, in our brains when we look at this yellow mug, for example?
Well, I think you summarize it very well already. I mean, it's an old-ish view, frankly, that goes back to Hermann von Helmholtz in the late 19th century, arguably back to Kant and perhaps Plato. You know, but of course, they weren't talking about things at the level of neurons. And now that's the level we want to talk about. Indeed, the key idea is that when the brain is trying to figure out what's going on out there in the world, it doesn't just sort of assemble a picture of the world in this sort of bottom-up or outside-in direction with information flowing into the brain and then being read out. The claim here is that the brain is solving a problem of inference. It's trying to combine the sensory signals with its prior expectations about what's happening. And the sensory signals really then serve to update these expectations to keep them geared to the world. So the brain is, in this sense, it's trying to figure out what is the most likely cause of the noisy and ambiguous sensory signals that it gets. And then comes the question of how brains actually do this in practice. And now this is the idea that brains have encoded in their structure something called a generative model. A generative model is basically a kind of model of how the world and the body works in terms of how it generates sensory signals, or how stuff going on within the world and body generates sensory signals. And that can be used to generate predictions about the sensory signals that the brain expects to get. Then those predictions can be compared with actual incoming sensory information. And if the brain updates its predictions to try to minimize these sensory prediction errors, then you can show mathematically that what you get is a sort of approximate best guess. And this idea, which has become known as predictive coding or predictive processing or active inference, that's a good way to think of it, that it's a neat trick for the brain to approximate Bayesian inference. And then within that view, in my specific take on it, it's an old view, my specific take on it is that, well, what we consciously experience is the sort of the joint content of the top-down predictions. And that's where the slogan of controlled hallucination comes from.
Yes, because the claim is that in the controlled hallucination view, the perceptual experience, and in this case, the experience of seeing a yellow mug, is determined by the content of the brain's top-down best guess and not by the bottom-up sensory signals. We never experience sensory signals themselves. We only ever experience our interpretations of them.
Yeah, of course, it gets more complicated. And so you know, one of the things we're working on in the lab now is now there are sort of extensions of this basic predictive coding scheme where, in fact, it does make sense in some contexts to think of the brain making predictions in a bottom-up or outside-in direction. And so what we're currently doing in my group, one of the projects, is, you know, can we make sense of that both computationally and experimentally? So a good intuitive example is, you know, you walk into, I don't know, you walk into a supermarket and you immediately experience the fact that you're in a supermarket very quickly, before you've kind of noticed all the details about who the people are, how many people there are, and what's on the shelves and so on. So you have this very rapid, we call it gist perception of what's going on. You see the wood before you see the trees. And this is hard to reconcile with this basic predictive coding controlled hallucination view, which takes some time. You have to have this back and forth between prediction and prediction error. The brain sort of settles on something. You know, my PhD student, Will Yum-Farnborough, is doing this based on some modeling work with Chris Buckley and Alec Chance. We're working with the idea that the brain can, in some cases, learn to map directly from sensory data to a Bayesian best guess. And it can do this when situations are relatively stable. So it can basically learn shortcuts. And this turns out to already be a technique in machine learning, that people use this technique called amortization to make learning algorithms more efficient. So I mention this because I think I want to emphasize that all of these things are provisional. And I think that's why they're exciting, because this idea to me has some conceptual force. It does useful work explaining things, but it's only a starting point. And you know, in the philosophy of science, the success of a given theory is ultimately, you know, it's difficult to judge of whether it's in itself right or wrong. Theories often succeed or fail based on whether they're productive or not. And being productive means they lead to new, further ideas, further experiments in a kind of virtuous circle. And so this idea seems to be doing that, you know, where it's leading on to other more interesting things, different experiments, different extensions that can explain different aspects of, in this case, visual consciousness.
And there are various powerful illusions you write about which show how our perceptual expectations shape our conscious experience. For example, you might see a dress as being one color and I might see it as being another, even though the light waves being reflected from the dress are exactly the same, because we could have different prior expectations and models of the world. Mm-hmm. And you've done experiments that show we consciously perceive things we expect more quickly and more easily than things we don't expect. And the larger claim of the controlled hallucination view is that it encompasses all our perceptual experiences, from our experience of causality to our sense of time, and even to our sense of self, which we'll get onto shortly. For example, you describe one experiment from your lab where you used fMRI to link brain activity in the visual cortex with the perceived duration of videos.
Yeah, so this is another, I think, sometimes overlooked aspect of conscious perception, which is the experience of time. I mean, we take it for granted, seems to just tick along in the background at this steady rate, even though we know colloquially that sometimes time drags and other times it whizzes by. And we sort of talk about this almost metaphorically, though it has, I think, a deep meaning experientially. Time does, in our experience, go more slowly and more quickly at different times. So how do we explain this? You know, I think kind of a similar way, that time is not, our experience of time is not a passive readout of objective time ticking by. It's something the brain infers in this case on the basis of meaningful perceptual change. And at least this is the hypothesis. So this was a hypothesis that's all credit is to my former postdoc and colleague now, Warwick Roseboom, who led all this work. And I didn't know anything about time perception when he started in the group. And he would probably say, I still don't know very much about it at all. And he's right. But it is this kind of flip from thinking of our experience of time as due to some sort of inner clock ticking away, which is a very homunculus-like theory of time perception. In the same way you might say, we've got a movie in the head. Well, you know, having a clock in the head is basically the time analog to that idea. Instead, Warwick's hypothesis was and still is that our experience of duration is this an inference based on the amount of salient perceptual change. The more salient perceptual change, the longer something subjectively seems. And so what he was able to do, and what I think are a series of really impressive experiments that he did in our group here, is build a computational model out of artificial neural network that was trained to do image classification. So not trained to do anything to do with time at all, and basically was able to use that to predict how human beings would judge the duration of different videos. And so that was a very nice, what we would now call exercise in computational phenomenology, you know, using computational models to say something about an experiential property, in this case, duration. And then with Maxine Sherman, who's also a colleague at Sussex, extended this into fMRI and showed indeed that if you substitute the activity in the model for the activity of, in this case, the visual cortex under fMRI, you could also predict subjective duration, you know, from activity, in this case, in the visual cortex. So it's still indirect, but I think together it's a kind of quite compelling story. And he's taking this further now to show that you can extend this model to not only deal with duration, but also to predict when people chunk a continuous stream of perceptual experience into distinct episodes. So this border between perception and memory, you know, that's a very interesting thing that needs to be explained as well. Why do we do that? When do we do that? And how do we do that?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons for why time seems to speed up when we're adults compared to when we're children is that we have fewer, newer experiences as adults compared to when we were kids, when everything is new. I mean, that's one of the speculations, I guess. And actually, researchers in Joe Patton's lab at the Champalimau Foundation manipulated the temperature of a brain region called the striatum in rats to speed up or slow down neural activity there. And they found that doing this directly altered how the animals judged the duration of short time intervals. So plenty of interesting work being done in this area. But before we move on to the topic of the self, which I really want to get your thoughts on, how do experiences like dreaming or daydreaming fit into the predictive processing or controlled hallucination framework? Because in these states, the images and the sounds are playing in our heads without really input from the outside world. So how does the idea that consciousness is built from a sequence of perceptual best guesses apply when really there's no sensory data coming in to shape our conscious perceptions?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, daydreaming and dreaming are very different things, of course. So daydreaming is, you know, we might also be called mind wandering. So that's colloquially when we get just distracted by and swept away by an internal stream of thought. And we experience that as it's a rather internal experience, right? We don't feel like we're experiencing a connection with the outside world so much in daydreaming. The case of dreaming, I think, has got a more direct connection. So in dreaming, typically we have rich perceptual experiences that we don't, unless we're lucid dreaming, we don't realize are dreams, even though strange things might happen. So one level you can think of this as, well, okay, it's in terms of predictive processing, it's the brain is still making a bunch of predictions about sensory signals, but it's not getting any sensory signal to update and calibrate these predictions. So what we experience is not a controlled hallucination, but it's kind of uncontrolled. So you can flip it around and say perception is controlled hallucination, and hallucination and dreaming are a kind of uncontrolled perception. There's a deeper question about why we experience anything, and because there's some stages of sleep that don't involve dreaming, that may have other physiological functions. One idea I quite like here is due to Eric Howell, who suggests that in the dreaming state, the brain is kind of free running its generative models as a way of statistically pruning them. We know in statistics that overtraining on data can be problematic, and you can sort of fit a model too closely to some data and you lose the ability to generalize to new situations that have not previously been encountered. So there's a nice idea here that dreaming is insurance against overfitting, that what you're doing when you're dreaming is pruning those aspects of your brain's generative model that might have overfit to the specifics of your recent waking experience. This leads to some nice predictions that, you know, if you don't dream, maybe you would generalize less well perceptually to novel situations. I don't know whether these have been borne out experimentally, but to me it's a nice theory because it sort of tries to explain dreaming at a very different level from, let's say, the psychoanalytic level of Freud, where you try to make sense of the contents of dreams in some way. It also explains why we forget our dreams. I mean, most people have very, very severe dream amnesia. They just disappear into a vapor seconds after waking up often. And this is frustrating, at least when you're trying to remember your dreams. But think of it this way. If you did remember all your dreams, it would be very confusing when you look back and you try and you had a memory and you were not able to distinguish whether that memory actually happened or whether it was just something you dreamt. So overall, I think it's quite adaptive for brains to not remember their dreams and then to think of the function of dreams, not as it showing you something that you need to see in order to live a better life, but maybe doing something a bit more low level, you know, as Eric Howell suggested, in pruning the generative models of the brain.
So in your book, you explore how the self, this feeling of being you, is itself a perception and another variety of controlled hallucination. And could you just talk to us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot to say. This tends to be where the book goes, but very briefly, and I'll keep it very brief, I think, that we tend to think of the self as the thing that does the perceiving. And again, this movie in the head metaphor or mismetaphor encourages that homuncular view of the self being the recipient of perceptions and the decider of the actions that follow some, you know, reasoning about what should be done next. But a different way to think of the self that, again, has many historical precedents, both in science and in culture, especially in things like Buddhism and so on, that the self is not a thing, it's not an essence, it's not a mini you perched inside your head. The self is also a kind of perception. And the brain is not only trying to infer the causes of sensory signals coming from outside the body, also trying to infer the causes of sensory signals coming from the body itself. And that is at least part of what I think underpins the experience of being a self. Just like consciousness is many things, selfhood is also many things, from personal identity and memory to emotion to volition and free will, to this basic experience of just being alive. And if you think of experiences of self as bundles of different kinds of perception that come together in a way that seems unified for us most of the time, but is not necessarily unified, I think that's a helps us account for how experiences of self change in psychiatry and neurology, but also many experiments where we can manipulate experiences of selfhood in various ways. But the core idea is the brain has to infer the state of the body just as it has to infer the state of the world beyond the body.
Yeah, and just as the brain seamlessly unifies sights, sounds, and smells into a single conscious experience so that the color and shape of a yellow mug become a single object, so it brings together our different selves, as you say, into a unified sense of being you. But, of course, this sense of unity can unravel. For instance, the narrative self, shaped by our personal history and memories, may erode or vanish in conditions like dementia or amnesia, while the volitional self, our sense of agency and intention, can break down in disorders such as schizophrenia or alien hand syndrome, where individuals feel disconnected from their own intentions or actions. And interestingly, emotions also seem to play a key role in holding the self together. For example, in Cotard syndrome, not sure if I pronounced that right, which you mentioned, where emotional processing is thought to be disrupted, people may believe they are dead or even no longer exist. And you explained that emotions and moods are forms of conscious content deeply rooted in the body, because unlike perceptions of the outside world, they're internally driven. And the idea that you put forward is that emotions are essentially top-down perceptual best guesses about signals coming from within, from the body's internal state and the causes behind it. And these guesses play a vital role in regulating key physiological variables like body temperature and blood sugar, helping to keep the body in balance. And this importance of the body in perception brings us to your beast machine theory of consciousness.
Yeah, thank you. And again, you've done a great job of summarizing what I think and what's in the book. So very little left for me to do, which is great. I mean, absolutely right. I would just say that these ideas are actually very similar to Antonio Damasio's, who's a very, you know, well-known Portuguese neuroscientist. Though, you know, I sort of tell the story in terms of predictive coding, which is something a bit different. And this does lead to this key point that you rightly mentioned, that one key difference between what I call interoceptive inference, so the idea of the brain making predictions about the internal state of the body, and exteroceptive inference, vision, sounds, all these things about that are about the world, is that the interoceptive case emphasizes control and regulation. There are two important things here. One is that this is really the primary duty of having a brain. Now, people will say, well, why do things have brains? It's not to do neuroscience. It may not even be to move, although that's arguable. I think movement, the ability of an organism to move, is strongly correlated with presence of a brain. But there's a more fundamental duty even than moving, which is keeping the body alive. That is the fundamental imperative of any living organism, is to keep on living. And it turns out that if you want to do that, then that involves controlling and regulating your physiological condition, blood pressure, heart rate, blood oxygenation, all of these things that have to remain within pretty tight ranges in order for life to remain viable. And this gives us a whole different reason for thinking about why brains are prediction machines in the first place. Prediction and predictive processing turns out to be an extremely good way of implementing control and regulation. This is now when it gets to be called active inference. More technically, your priors here, you know, your prior expectations about the way things are, in the control view, they serve as set points, you know, what you want the system to be like. And now, instead of updating your priors as the data come in, you make actions to ensure that your priors are self-fulfilling. So it's kind of self-fulfilling predictive processing, control-oriented predictive processing, active inference. All of these things are mostly equivalent. And so you can see the whole story playing out in this other direction, that organisms need to stay alive. Staying alive needs physiological regulation. physiological regulation, when it gets sufficiently complex, requires kind of predictive control. So you keep yourself within bounds proactively rather than letting your body temperature get too high and then trying to bring it back down again. And so you already get this whole architecture of predictive processing installed in the brain without even having to think about the problem of perceiving the external world. And that's really the story that I tell in the book, that in fact, it's another flip. Not only do we see the world from the inside out rather than the outside in, but the reason we see the world at all is because of this predictive machinery that operates moment to moment, developed and evolved in the context of control and regulation of the living body. We experience the world and the self with, through, and because of our living bodies. That's the claim of the beast machine idea in the book.
Right. As you say, our conscious experience is the way it is because it helps guide our actions and behavior in ways that promote our survival. And even though this conscious experience is shaped by the brain's internal models of the world, it's crucial that we don't experience the models as models, but that we experience them as reality itself. And you say that the conscious experience of self and volition, the feeling that I'm doing what I want to do and that I could have done otherwise, serves an important function. It helps to flag up instances of voluntary behavior so that we can then pay attention to their consequences and adjust our actions as needed in the future to better achieve our goals and to survive. And in the final part of your book, you talk about whether machines can be conscious. And you discuss the idea of functionalism, which is that consciousness doesn't depend on what a system is made of, whether neurons or silicon, but only on what the system does. If a system transforms inputs into outputs in the right way, there will be consciousness. But this is a view that you are skeptical of.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good place to land now. I mean, it's very, very current, right, isn't it? With the hype and the fury around AI. You know, people talk about it in terms of doomer situations. It's going to take over the world, or it's going to save the world, or some combination of both. And animating some of these discussions is the idea about whether AI could be not only smart, but also conscious. I mean, some people think it already is. But it does raise this fundamental question about, does consciousness depend on what a system is made out of? Or does it just depend on what a system does? And the way you described it, it's actually a little more differentiated than that, in a way that I think is worth dwelling on. So there's this kind of claim that's been around for a while. Sometimes it's just not even stated as an assumption. People just assume it, that computation is sufficient for consciousness. This is called computational functionalism. So it's a more specific position. Functionalism in general, which goes back to Hilary Putnam in the 1960s, doesn't say anything specifically about computation. It just says that consciousness is a property of the functional organization of a system. So importantly, that can be more than just its inputs, outputs, but how it's organized internally as well. But computational functionalism, which is often mixed up with functionalism in general, is the specific claim that computation is enough. And computation is really about algorithms. So it's mapping inputs to outputs. So it's a much stronger claim that if a system maps out inputs to outputs in the right way, it implements the right kinds of computations, then it's conscious. That's the only reason we might expect AI to be conscious, is if computation of the right kind is enough. And I'm kind of skeptical of this. And I'm skeptical of it for all sorts of reasons, but fundamentally they come down to what we were just saying, that I think the right way to think about brains is as deeply embodied organs that are fundamentally related to, involved in this business of keeping the body alive. And through that lens, they're very different from any kind of computer. I mean, a key insight here is that in computers, the reason computation is so powerful is that there's a sharp separation between software and hardware. Now, you can run different programs on the same computer or the same program on different computers, and you're fine. that's a constraint that was imposed on computers by human design to make them useful. Evolution had no such constraint. And if you look inside a brain, you do not see a separation between what we might call mindware and wetware. And the larger point here is it's very hard, if not impossible, to separate what brains do, their functional organization, from what they are, what they're made of, and how they're actually made up. And if you can't do that, there's much less motivation to think of the right level of description as being computational. The reason we favor computational descriptions is when we can have this separability between the role and the realizer, you know, what something is and what it does. And if there's no such separation, then computation becomes a useful descriptive language, but it's not necessarily what the system does. Another way to think of it is simply that we've always worked with technological metaphors for the brain, and the brain as a computer has been a very powerful metaphor for a long time. But metaphors in the end are always metaphors, and we usually end up in trouble if we confuse the metaphor with the thing itself, if we mistake the map for the territory. So there's a couple of reasons. There are many other reasons I'm suspicious of this. But the bottom line is, like, if we think about conscious experience, even phenomenologically, is grounded in this staying alive, and we look very carefully at the differences between living systems and non-living systems, then the prospects of actually conscious AI, I think, recede dramatically.
Another possible confusion that you point out in the book is, if something is really intelligent, then consciousness will just come along for the ride. But consciousness and intelligence shouldn't be confused as one and the same. And in the book, you describe a fascinating thought experiment, a robot that has a model of its environment and body, makes best guesses about sensory and internal signals, and behaves in ways that give the impression of agency and intelligence. And yet, your intuition, Anil, is that it still wouldn't be conscious. So why, in your view, might being alive in the biological cellular sense be essential for consciousness in a way that information processing alone might not be?
So this stands as, if you like, my current hypothesis. I don't know whether it's right, and I don't think you can directly test it. You can more sort of motivate it, although I think that hopefully will change. This does return us to this idea of the origin of predictive processing in physiological regulation. And we end up, when we pull on this thread long enough, we end up in the quite tricky territory of something called the free energy principle, which has been developed most prominently by Carl Friston, and very, very hard to make sense of. I struggled for a long time, still not sure I understand it. But at one level, I think I find it very useful. And that level is of indeed thinking of systems that actively maintain their identity and their organization and their boundaries between what the system is and what it isn't. So a cell is a prototypical example of a system that continually remakes itself, that continually remakes its own border, lipid bilayer between what's in the cell and what's outside the cell. This requires the minimization of a kind of free energy. It requires the system to maintain itself out of equilibrium with its environment. So it's trying to minimize the surprisingness of the state that it finds itself in. It has to be in states it expects statistically to be in. And you can begin to draw a direct line from that to the minimization of prediction error in this broader picture of the brain as a prediction machine. And that, for me, is one motivating line, that this same fundamental process of minimization of prediction error is sort of metabolic at one level and you know, more informational at another level, but it's the same principle running through both. And there's even interesting kind of physical and mathematical equivalences between free energy in a thermodynamic sense and free energy in an informational or variational sense. So I think there's some fascinating theoretical clues about a deep unity here. And there's also a phenomenological appeal to it too, that if we think about every conscious experience that we have, it's in some sense, it's reflecting the prospects for survival of the organism. Now, at the core of consciousness, arguably, there's this mere sense of being alive, the feeling of being alive. And in the abstractions of information processing, you don't really have any of this. I think that's the view that you get to if you start with the thought that what's most characteristic of consciousness is some sort of rational problem solving. But that's a, I think that's a legacy of Descartes still, who, you know, who famously or infamously associated consciousness with some supposedly distinctive human rational ability. But I think the more serious you are about what phenomenologically conscious experiences are like, certainly if you look beyond the human, you're going to deprioritize that kind of conscious experience as being actually rather special, contingent to the human condition. But conscious experience in general is likely to be much more tied up with these basic experiences of living. So there's a whole bunch of reasons, but it's not that I can demonstrate it to be true, or I have like 100% confidence this being right. It also doesn't mean that you have to be carbon chauvinistic. Now, there might be the relevant features might be replicable in different substrates, but perhaps not any substrate. I mean, there's so many differences between the dead sand of silicon and the active matter of biology that it'd be weird if that didn't make a difference.
The fact that the difference between a machine and a living being is that the living being is composed of cells, living cells, right down to the very core. And so even a silicon beast machine would not have these fundamental life processes that apply all the way down.
That's right. Thank you for returning. I'd forgotten all about that thought experiment. But yes, that indeed is one of the core differences. That there's a lovely word from the Chilean biologist Maturana and Varela, autopoiesis. And living systems are autopoietic. They produce themselves, autopoiesis. Artifacts like computers or cars or factories are allopoietic. They don't produce themselves. Silicon beast machines don't produce themselves. You can kind of get a little bit that way if you say, okay, I've got now a self-repairing silicon beast machine that knows when it's running out of battery and or can go to a workshop and fix a damaged leg. But that's only autopoietic in a very weak sense. You know, living systems are autopoietic in the true sense of the word, which is the very stuff they're made of is self-producing. And does that make a difference? That for me is one of the key open questions. And by the way, it doesn't mean that everything that is alive is conscious. That would be a kind of biopsychist perspective. So being necessary does not mean being sufficient.
Yeah, because it's easy to forget, but every cell in our body is constantly regenerating the conditions necessary for its own survival and integrity over time.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think that would be a perfect point at which to close this conversation. I strongly recommend people read the book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Anil, how can people follow your work and learn more about it?
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. Well, you just mentioned the most obvious way, which is, read the book or listen to it. It's on Audible too. That what we've been talking about has nicely, I think, described what I go into in more detail in the book. Besides that, then the easiest way is I have a website, anilseth.com, or I'm still on X for my sins with Anil K. Seth, or Anilseth at Blue Sky as well. But easiest thing is just to go to the website.
And we always close the episode, Anil, by asking guests to recommend a book to listeners, be it fiction or nonfiction. You've already recommended one. Do you have any others?
Oh, yeah. This is a good question. I'm going to recommend two. I hope that's all right.
Sure.
So the first one is an old book, but it still rewards reading. It's Daniel Dennett's Consciousness Explained. Many people listening may have read it. Now, I read it when it was nearly new, when I was just starting out as an undergrad in the early 90s. But I reread it a couple of years ago, and I was surprised by, you know, I got to know Daniel Dennett towards the end of his life, and I now have a renewed admiration for how patient he is, because we were basically still asking him loads of questions, which he'd answered in his book in 1990 or something. It's still a very relevant book to read. It's still very prescient. I mean, there are some parts where things have gone off in different directions, but even those are very interesting. So I highly recommend Consciousness Explained. And then the other is a nonfiction book. We finished our conversation talking about artificial consciousness, the possibility of machines that not only think but also feel. And science fiction has done a remarkable job of interrogating these kinds of scenarios, I think far better than academia so far. And I could give many, many examples, but the one I would really recommend is a book by Katsuo Ishiguro, British-Japanese novelist, and it's called Clara and the Sun. It's a novel about the world from the perspective of a putatively conscious robot, but it goes off in directions which are really kind of strange, and it's beautifully written and it's very thought-provoking.
Wonderful. Anil, thank you so much for this fascinating conversation and for helping to reshape how we think about what it means to be us. And to everyone listening, thanks for joining us and see you next time.
Thanks very much, Hedy.